Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Jessica Blaustein Marshall, in for Ray Graff, who's a little under the weather today. We're talking automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon, who is one of our longtime experts, has been in the automotive repair and service industry for over 30 years, beginning at a factory mechanics training school in Wolfsburg, Germany, back in 1979. From there, he moved on to earn an associate's degree in automotive mechanics from Hudson Valley Community College and a Bachelor of Science degree in vocational technical education at the State University of New York's College of Technology in Utica. Prior to starting his own business in Hoosick Falls, Gordon worked as an automotive technician, service advisor, and assistant service manager at the Annis Corporation, a Volkswagen, Porsche, and Audi dealership based in Natick, Massachusetts. Gordon Fricke, welcome back to the Vox Pop. It is so good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be back.
You can call us with your car questions at 1-800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. And you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. Oh, and there's one more thing. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So lots of ways to get in touch with us and have your questions answered by Gordon. So before we take a few calls, let's talk about winterizing our cars, specifically our tires.
Yeah, that's a great subject because tires very often get overlooked in terms of their tread depth and also the type of tire. And there's a big difference between snow or winter tires and all season or summer tires. And it's not just the way the tread looks or if the tread is plenty deep enough. A lot has to do with the construction of the tread. And winter tires are much softer and they don't freeze and get very hard in super cold weather. So the tire maintains its grip, and the treads can kind of work their way around pieces of ice or slush or snow and also channel it out of the way so the tread keeps making contact with the road. I also do quite a bit of towing, and I'll get a lot of cars that are stuck or slipped off the road or, worse, crashed, and I'll oftentimes look at the tires and just say, my goodness, I can't believe that this person even made it this far. Huh. And a lot of it's to the driver's surprise. They will say, well, nobody ever mentioned this to me. You know, I had my oil changed a month ago, and, you know, nobody said you should do something with your tires. So it's something that really needs to get looked at very carefully, particularly now with the winter driving season just underway.
Now, typically, when would you advise people to pay attention to that and do something about that? Is that something that you should do at the end of the summer? Is that something that you should do now? Is it too late? When's the best time?
It's really never too late in terms of either getting some better tires or new tires. Having the shop that does your maintenance, changes your oil, just maybe advise them to take a look at the tires and get a good opinion on them. The tire is most effective from when it's brand new, which is about 10/32 of an inch of tread depth, to about 5/32, which is about half worn. Well, then you say, what do you do with the rest of the half? Well, the tire is still okay, but it starts to lose its effectiveness. And in the winter, with slush and snow, that's when you want it to have the deepest amount of tread. So tires that are 5/32 or less are going to be less effective in the winter. So measuring sometimes is a good idea, and a tire shop can do that.
Mm-hmm. And what about rotating tires?
A very good idea. It's advised to do a tire rotation. Some car manufacturers vary, but 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 mile intervals, and it keeps the tires wearing evenly, so you don't have badly worn, for example, front tires and very good deep tread on the rear. Puts the car out of balance. It won't handle properly. If you keep them balanced, they'll all try to remain the same depth, and you'll get the maximum life out of the tires.
Hmm.
And they're expensive, so you want to push them as long as you can, but still be safe.
Indeed, indeed. Well, let's go to the phones. They are filling up really fast. Let's start with Merle in Argyle, New York. Merle, how are you?
Doing fine.
Great.
This is a tire question. So you said rotate. With radials, you just rotate them front to back, right?
Well, that used to be the rule in the early years of radial tires, Merle. But now the construction of the radial tire changed, and they can be put in any direction that you want, as long as it's not a directional tire to begin with.
What so, do you mean?
A lot of tires have a tread design that allows or that requires the tire to travel in one rotation only. And in that case, the tire needs to be rolling in the same direction, and it can be on the front or the back. But you have to be careful. If you cross-rotate them, you're going to change the direction of the tire. And that's more of a traction and control issue, not so much the construction of the tire.
So it's better off just going front to back.
Front to back is a very...
And keep the same right side on the right side and left side on the left side.
Yeah, it's a very safe bet to go front to rear, and then they all stay pointing in the same direction.
Yeah, okay. Well, the question I had was... the tire sensors. I got a 2007 Colorado, four-wheel drive. I bought new tires a year or so ago, and one developed a leak, so I took it back to the tire guy, and it was a sensor. And that cost over $100 to replace. But then he said that the service TPM or whatever it is, might go off. If it does, come back and he'll fix it. Well, I took it back, and now the other three, the one he replaced, he ended up replacing one that was leaking air or something.
Mm-hmm.
And now the other three are not working. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Here's the thing.
And that's $100 a tire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Screwed something up changing the tire?
Well, here's the thing with the tire pressure sensors. In the case of your car, they are battery-operated transponders inside your tire, right behind the valve stem.
Right.
They measure the temperature and the pressure inside the tire, and then they send a radio signal to the computer in your car, and that's how it knows what the tires are up to.
Right.
The batteries in those sensors have a lifespan like any battery. And generally, they're saying that's about a 6-year lifespan. I see some lasting way longer. But eventually, those batteries will go dead in everybody's tire pressure sensors, and it'll turn that warning light on. So the shop will have a special tool that tests the sensor to see if it's still sending out its signal.
Right.
And also,
they were nothing coming out of the three other tires.
I would dare say they've all died. And you can choose not to replace them. And your tire light will be on all the time.
Yeah.
But
it
to get
has
that,
been.
Yeah. To get that system back working, it looks to me like you're going to need the other three replaced.
All right. Now, when I take it in to have it inspected, are they going to fail it because that light's on?
No, that will not fail a New York State inspection.
Oh, okay. All right. So I'll either start saving up some money or just put up with it.
Yes, you're among many people because that tire sensor issue started mandatory in 2009, but a lot of cars got it sooner. So there's going to be a lot of those sensors failing, and people may opt not to fix them.
All right, Merle. Thanks
all right.
so much.
Thank
Good
you very
luck.
Much.
Best of yep. luck to you.
Bye.
All right, we're going to go next to Steve in Charlton, New York. Steve, you're on.
Hi. I drive on a 96 Jeep Cherokee Sport, and I have this very intermittent starter problem where I go to turn the key, and it makes the god-awful grinding noise. And it seems to go away if I put the shifter into neutral instead of the park position.
So the sound it makes, do you think it's a real heavy grinding as if the starter has not fully engaged properly with the flywheel? I mean, is it very loud?
Yes.
I don't know if, when you take your shifter and go from park to neutral, you didn't really do anything but engage and disengage the park neutral safety switch that allows it to crank. So what I think is happening is you may be having a starter issue, hopefully not a flywheel issue that the starter engages into. But if that happens more often, you'll want to take it to the shop, and the mechanic will take a look at the condition of the flywheel, the teeth on the flywheel, and also the condition of the end of the starter. Because I think you might be in the early stages of a starter failure. Hopefully not a flywheel issue, but I think I should. Are there a lot of miles on that vehicle?
Yeah, 175.
Yeah, that's quite a bit. So it's had a lot of starts in its life. But
I think it's been doing it for about a year now.
It may not be that the flywheel is the culprit. It could be the starter itself. Okay. I think I'd get it checked, because if the starter fails, you know, now it's tow truck time, and you still have to get it fixed.
Right.
So I'd get it looked at.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve. Good luck to you. We're going to take a short break right now. We'll be right back with our guest, Gordon Fricke.
Support comes from Edward Garbasik, certified financial planner serving all of Western Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. ed@havokinwealthstrategies.com. Epic 18 Vermont Artisans Manchester Center, an artisan-owned and operated cooperative craft gallery honoring handmade traditions and contemporary design. epochvermont.com. And Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York, an independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And Antioch University, New England's doctoral program in clinical psychology, working to provide transformative education for the real world, accepting applications for the fall semester until January 5th. AntiochNE.edu.
And we're back on the Vox Pop, the Automotive Repair Edition, with our guest, Gordon Fricke, here to answer your car questions. Gordon, a quick question before we go back to the calls. In the Northeast, obviously, we deal with the winter. We deal with it a lot. Do you have any recommendations, without naming brands or any of that stuff, just something to look for in a car that you're purchasing in the Northeast?
You mean in terms of buying a new car, used
yes.
car, or just any purchase?
Just any purchase.
I'll tell you what's become incredibly popular is an all-wheel drive car. And Subaru has, everything Subaru makes is all-wheel drive. Audi started it a long time ago with their Quattros in the 80s. If you've ever driven an all-wheel drive car, they're phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
The traction is incredible. What you have to be careful of is steering and stopping, because the all-wheel drive helps you get going and trudge through the snow, but when you go to stop and steer, it's a different story. But the popularity of an all-wheel drive car in the Northeast is incredible. So, you know, if you really want to plow through all kinds of weather, if you have a nasty commute, all-wheel drive cars are certainly the thing to look for. Most everything now is front-wheel drive. There was a time many years ago where you had a rear-wheel drive car with the engine in the front, and they were bad in snow because they were so light in the rear, and they would spin and fishtail and do all that stuff.
My father had one of those. He lamented the decision and then went to an all-wheel drive car soon afterward.
Yeah, major change.
Indeed.
So, I mean, those are some things to be concerned with as far as traction and safety and handling go.
All right. Well, let's take one from the email here. Says, I just got a 2014 Honda CR-V and was reading the owner's manual, which said to always use the handbrake whenever you park. I recall hearing on Car Talk to only use it when you park on a hill. What do you think?
I love that question, because most owner's manuals will advise you to come to a full stop, apply the parking brake, then put it in park.
Interesting.
And that's the procedure. Yes.
I guess I should read my owner's manual.
The parking mechanism in the automatic transmission was not completely or wholly designed to hold the vehicle. It's there to stop the transmission, and it does lock up the wheels, but it's advisable to put the parking brake on to get the braking wheels turned on, which in most, almost all of your cars, they're turning the back, they're applying the rear brakes, and that takes the pressure off of the park. So the Car Talk guys were correct in saying it, do it on hills, but you really should do it every time you stop the car.
Interesting. So you just stop, you pull into a parking spot, you pull the e-brake, and then you pull the car into park.
Yes.
That's what you're saying?
And that's what I always do, because I always had manual shift cars. So it was just common practice to always put the parking brake on, because you didn't want to just leave it in gear.
Mm-hmm.
But when everybody, you know, most people drive automatics now, you think, I'll just throw it in park and that's fine. But you really should use that parking brake. So that's a good question.
That's a great question. I never would have known that.
You going to start doing it now?
I am, actually. As soon as I go out to my car, I will do it. All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Bruce in Del Mar. Bruce, you're on.
Yeah, I have a 2004 Buick, and I was reliably told that I need a new catalytic converter. How long can I drive this car safely without replacing the catalytic converter?
Bruce, your need for the catalytic converter, I'm assuming the check engine light is on and somebody
Yeah, that's correct.
And somebody has done a scan or a diagnostic on the car and discovered that it was like a code PL420 maybe?
I don't know the code, but he told me I needed a new catalytic. The car has 142,000 miles.
Yep. The reason that the light is on now is that the onboard diagnostics that are built into your car's computer, or all cars today, really, built after 1996, checks the efficiency of that catalytic converter. And if it falls below a certain level, it'll turn that check engine light on, and you'll get a code for catalytic converter inefficiency. It doesn't mean that your catalytic converter is plugging up or falling apart where it may cause you to break down or not be able to drive the car. Mm-hmm. But if the converter has really stopped doing its job, that check engine light's going to be on forever.
Yeah.
And then when you go to get the car inspected, if you're in New York State, it won't pass.
Yeah.
But as far as you being concerned about breaking down, I don't think you need to worry about that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Bruce.
Bye.
All right. Next, we will go to Dick in Longmeadow. Dick, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is more of an academic question, but when you bought a V8 car, let's say 1960, 65, brand new, the compression ratio was 10 to 1, 11 to 1. And they say today when you buy a V8 car, it's not as much compression per cylinder as the older cars. And I was just wondering, is that related to gas mileage or the type of gasoline? Or could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, that's a good question. Car makers don't talk a lot about compression ratios anymore, but in the muscle car era, it was a big thing, because the higher the compression ratio can be, the more horsepower the engine will develop. It's a very quick and easy way to gain horsepower by increasing the compression ratio. But when you do that, you have to have adequate gas so it doesn't pre-ignite and cause pinging and detonation. So the olden days, if you had a high-performance car with a high compression ratio, you needed to run the highest octane gas, super high test. Now it's 93, I think, is about the highest you can get.
Detonation as in...
Well, yeah,
explode?
It's not quite that horrible of a term inside of an engine, but
it's not a Michael Bay movie.
No, the engine's not going to explode under the hood, but you can get what they call detonation, and when the compressed gas and air in the cylinder doesn't fire at the right time, or it fires too quickly, it detonates or pre-combusts, and that causes a terrible knocking sound, and it can be hard on the engine. And modern cars today have sensors and devices to prevent that from happening. But Dick's question is true, that higher compression equals higher horsepower, if that answers your question.
And the newer V8s today don't have that compression, do they?
Well, you could still get that, you could find that ratio, but you don't hear much talk about it anymore. And
right.
It's all about, you know, horsepower now, which is incredibly high again.
Right.
But
well, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It.
Thanks, Dick. Good luck.
Yep. Bye-bye.
All right, next we will go to Andrew in Lenox, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm driving, I have a similar question to one of the previous callers. I have a 1996 Toyota Corolla, and the similar problem is that whenever I'm stopped at, like, a stoplight or a red light, and the car is in drive, I have, I wouldn't call it a grinding sound like the last guy, but it's a bit of a rattling or a knocking sound at the front of the car. Similarly, the sound disappears if I'm in park or neutral. And I was just wondering, because I looked this up online, and this sort of gave a wide range of options for what it could be. And I was just wondering if you had any sort of insight into the problem.
Yes. The previous caller, he was having the noise during starting, during cranking.
Okay.
But you seem to be having the noise when you come to, let's say, a red light, and you're sitting and waiting for the light to change.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you put the car in park or neutral, the noise goes away.
Yes, it
yeah,
does.
Yeah. More than likely what you have happening is you've got a rattling from probably an exhaust shield or something to do with the exhaust system that is either too close to another component. It may have a broken hanger or a mount. But I think you might have an exhaust-related rattling.
Okay. And how urgent would you say that is to get fixed?
Not particularly if that's what's happening. If you bring it in for service at some point, and ask the shop, describe that and ask them to check it. Sometimes it's very easy. Sometimes we just have to reclamp those shields, bend something out of the way, but it's very common. It's a very common, complaint nowadays.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah.
All right. The lines are still loaded here. We'll go to Joel in Clintondale, New York. Joel, you're on.
Joel? Hi there.
Hi.
Hello. I'm wondering if there's there are aftermarket sources for body panels made with carbon fiber. The fiberglass panels I have seem to be very fragile.
What kind of a car are you thinking about, or is this just
Mazda
in general?
Mazda 3.
And what body? You need new body panels on the car? Is that what?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really don't think you're going to find carbon fiber for that particular car.
Gotcha.
The new Corvettes have carbon fiber panels. Very, very high-end exotic cars are using carbon fiber nowadays.
Yeah, that's what I gathered. Tesla's doing it.
Yeah, Audi R8, I believe, has some carbon fiber in it. But in your mainstream passenger cars, it's too expensive. It's just not practical to use. But it's a fantastic material. But you won't see it on, you know, mainstream cars.
I understand. Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thank you, Joel. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551 if you have a car question for our expert, Gordon Fricke. All right. Next, we will go to Catherine in Troy. Catherine, you're on.
Hi there.
Hello.
I've had probably 10 cars in the course of my life, and two of them, one was a minivan, and this current one is a Honda Accord, developed a musty smell when the air conditioner was running in the summer, and then what recently happened is when I would use the defrost system. And so my mechanic put an antibacterial stuff in the compressor box. I think that's where they did it, in addition to putting in a new filter. So why did only two of my 8 cars develop that problem? And is there a way to avoid it going forward?
Yeah. That's not an uncommon situation. What is the current car?
A Honda Accord.
And what was the last car that you had this happen with?
A minivan,
okay. The smell almost always is from bacteria that develops from all the moisture being in the air conditioning heating housing.
Yep.
And moisture is naturally developed from the air conditioner when it dehumidifies the air. And there are drains that carry the water out. And you'll see in the summertime cars dripping water from underneath. And that's
right.
That's from the air conditioner. It would be very important to make sure that drain is perfectly clear on that car. And I don't know if your mechanic did that. This time of the year, it's not such an issue because the air conditioner isn't doing much work. It still is being called on to dehumidify the air for the windshield, but...
Yeah, that's what they said.
Yeah, it would be very nice to make sure that drain is clear, and it's difficult to get a view of that evaporator on some cars to see what it looks like, you know, to see if there's must or mold or stuff going on in there. And he did spray the inside of that evaporator, I think what you said, with an antibacterial product.
Right.
Yeah, and that's what we do. We change the filter, the cabin filter, and then give it a heavy dose of this spray. And a lot of times they'll recommend you leave it overnight, you know, spray it and just leave the car sitting. So he's done everything that he should be doing, and I would just want to make sure that the drain was clear. And if it's really bothering you, ask him to try to get a view of the evaporator by taking out maybe the blower motor or something to see if there's some stuff in there that's a heavier buildup than usual.
They took out the blower motor when they were doing this whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So moving forward, what is the name? I'm going to write it down. The name of the thing that drains that needs to be kept clean?
Well, it's just the drain for your air conditioning or your evaporator housing. And it's literally just a little water drain. It's usually a little like a rubber hose that carries the water away.
And just some cars get clogged up and then
yeah.
the bacteria grows and
yeah.
some don't. It's
yep.
just a real...
Yeah, some cars are more prone to that hose plugging up, and then when it plugs up, the water never completely drains, and there's just too much water lingering in there.
Yeah, in the dark and the whatever.
Yeah, it's a perfect spot.
Okay, so how often would you suggest that a mechanic look for the drain clogging up?
Well, I would definitely check it maybe a couple times a year just to be on the safe side, because if you have a car that's prone to it, it may reoccur.
Okay, good point.
All right, thank you so much, Catherine. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, I had that issue when I turn on my air conditioner after a big, long winter of not using it.
You get that smell?
Yeah, but it's very brief, and it goes away after, you know, one car ride. And then, you know, I pop on my air freshener, and everything's good.
It's very, very common. It happens with lots of cars, and some it dries out and goes away so fast that you say, oh, that's just the way it is and it's fine now. But other cars, it lingers like the last caller.
Now, if we lived in, say, Arizona or New Mexico or somewhere that was dry and hot all the year round, would that be as much of a problem?
I don't think so. I think if you switch to Florida and humid southern states, I think it'd be a big issue.
Interesting. Well, a reminder that you can call us at 1-800-348-2551 if you have a question about your car. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment on today's Vox Pop post on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. And you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. Oh, also, you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Those lines are full. So if you want to get your question in, those are other ways that you can do it. All right. Let's go to Stephen in Newburgh, New York. Stephen, you're on. Stephen?
Hi. I got a 2007 Sport Track Ford, and it's an all-wheel drive, and approximately 43 miles per hour the vehicle like shakes like it's going over the rumble strip.
Mm-hmm.
And my gas mileage is very poor. It's around like 12 miles per gallon at all times, even on highway. So I went up to some forums and I looked up some different symptoms. And something that stuck out was the actuator that makes it two-wheel drive, and that possibly went wrong, and it's staying at four-wheel drive all the time. So when I brought it in, I brought it into a Ford dealership, and they came back with, I needed new ball joints, and they replaced those. They broke the knuckle while replacing it, so I had to pay for that. So So $1,400 later, I'm driving out of the parking lot, and at 43 miles per hour, the vehicle's shaking.
Yeah,
so I don't know what to tell.
Does the shake go away if you go above 43?
Yes. It's only when I hit that like section right there around like 43 to 45, and then the entire vehicle just shakes. And then goes away.
If you were to take your foot off the gas pedal in the middle of that shake, does the shake stop? Have you ever experimented with that?
I didn't, but I know that when I decelerate and it goes to 43 again, like if I'm at 55, it still does it.
Yeah, so it's happening at that critical speed. Here's a couple things you can do. Go 45 or 43, whatever has that shaking, and on a nice straight road, put it in neutral. Take your foot off the gas and put it in neutral. And see if the shake immediately stops. If it doesn't stop, and I don't know what the last, if the dealership checked for maybe a bent drive shaft or bent wheels or out around tires, but I guess the thing to do is to try to determine if it's a drivetrain issue or if it's a engine issue. You know, if it's the engine misfiring or running poorly at that speed and transferring that into the drive line, and you can't tell the difference. All you know is it shakes.
Yeah.
But I think what you need to do is try to separate the two, if it's engine transmission related or if it's drivetrain. But I think you're going to have to take it in somewhere and go for a ride with somebody so everybody is on the same page as to what the symptoms are and what time they occur. Because I don't think the ball joints were part of this. It doesn't sound like it was because it's still shaking. I'm sure they were, you know, they were probably badly worn, but I think it's going to take you and a mechanic together to reproduce the problem and then try to solve it that way. But it's not a specific problem that I've run into that I can throw, you know, one suggestion and say this is probably what it is, because I think it's going to require some diagnosis.
All right, yeah. Stephen, thank you so much. Good luck with that.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, take care. All right, we're going to take a quick break now. We'll be back in a couple seconds with Gordon Fricke, our automotive repair expert.
Support comes from Hudson Wine Merchants, Hudson, New York. Celebrating 10 years of wine and food in the Hudson Valley, raise your glass, hudsonwinemerchants.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Winslow Homer, The Nature and Rhythm of Life, only through January 4th, 2015. ArkellMuseum.org. And Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities, open 7 days a week. YeOldWarwickBookshop.com.
And we're back with Gordon Fricke of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated in Hoosick Falls, New York. He's here to answer your questions about all things cars and car repair. Before we go back to the phones, we're going to take a quick email here from Phil in Slingerlands. My 2012 Toyota Camry has the original antifreeze at 28,000 miles. The owner's manual does not indicate a time or mileage period to flush and replace. What's your recommendation?
Yeah, good question. Because in the early days, and I don't know how early we should go, but there was a time when antifreeze needed to be changed almost yearly. The additives and the technology in the coolant wasn't as good, and it didn't hold up as long, and it would start to allow corrosion, and maybe freezing protection would slide. So coolants today... And the reason I call it coolant is because it's not only preventing from freezing, but it's also helping to, or it is cooling the engine. They last a long time. Some are considered lifetime. So if you went into your maintenance manual and advanced that up to maybe 100,000 mile range, you may see an interval. There will be a change interval for that car at some point, but it's going to be pretty far up the scale. I would dare say it's close to 100,000 miles, which might equate to, I don't know, 6 years of use or something like that.
Wow. So yeah. You got a long way to go.
Yeah, he's
there.
Got a ways to go.
Keep driving. All right. We'll go back to the phones. We are going next to Ted in Germantown, New York. Ted, you're on.
Hey, everybody. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good.
Good. My question is about octane and the levels of octane in gas. And I want to know if that's just a myth from the gas companies, or does that really matter, number one? And number two, if you drive a car that doesn't need the higher octane gases, does it help to put it in occasionally?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We get that a lot. There was a time when cars were switching from carburetors to fuel injection back in the 1980s and 90s, and gas was a big issue because the gasoline wasn't ready for fuel injection, and big deposits were starting to develop, and engines were starting to get plugged up and running terribly. The gas companies are all on board now because everything is fuel injected, and that has to do with levels of detergent. And that's the key. That used to be the key, and sometimes you could only find high detergents in the premium gases, so people had to buy high test. Today, most of your mainstream cars and light trucks are made to run on regular gasoline, which I believe is 87 octane.
Right.
Some higher-end cars, turbocharged cars, higher performance. You'll see a recommendation on the gas door or in the owner's manual, well, saying 91 minimum. I don't think there's too many cars that require higher than that, but they do offer it. You'll see at gas stations 93. If your car was designed for 91, you should use it because you'll get the best efficiency, the best gas mileage, and the best performance. You drop down to 89, the car will survive because the sensors on board will notice the octane, the lower octane, and make adjustments. And you might have a little bit lower performance than you're used to, but you may not even notice it under normal conditions. So I would see what your car is recommended to use, and you really, there's no benefit of using anything higher than that.
Okay, that was good, because I wanted to know if it occasionally just helps to put in a higher rate, but I guess it doesn't.
No, it doesn't, because the whole issue is detergents and keeping the valve train and intake track clean, and all your name brand gasolines have that pretty well covered, but there are additives recommended to use occasionally. Ray and I talk about it a lot because he has a Cadillac V8 Northstar engine that he's petrified of, and I recommend using a very high quality fuel injection cleaner periodically, just to sharpen things up, just to get the deposits cleaned up that the gas hasn't taken care of. So I think that's it.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Ted. So if you put a lower octane gas in your car when your car was designed for a higher one long-term, does that do long-term damage?
Potentially. Mm-hmm. So let's say your car was designed to run a 91. And you said, I'm only going to run 87.
Mm-hmm.
If the controls that prevent this detonation that we were talking about earlier, the pinging and the knocking, can't control it, and it does ping and detonate, the answer is yes. You could have engine damage resulting in gas with too low an octane. So it is entirely possible.
All right. Well, I'm going to stick with my 87 because that's what my car was designed for. All right, let's go back to the phones. We're going, oh, by the way, if you do want to call, the number is 1-800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also comment on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet. You can send us an email. If those lines are loaded, you can go through those avenues as well. So going back to the phones, we have Steve in Watervliet. Steve, you're on.
Hello. I had a little, somebody bumped into my passenger side rear view mirror in a parking lot and broke it off, and it was just sort of hanging there by the wires and stuff. So I fixed it with some Gorilla tape, and it works perfectly fine. The defroster works, and it adjusts and everything, but I wonder, is that going to pass my inspection or not?
Yeah, this is the passenger side, you said, correct?
Yeah, the other two mirrors are fine.
Yeah, as far as I know, it always was that the car has to have a side view mirror on the driver's door, and and I believe it has to also have the rear view mirror on the windshield. The passenger side mirror was always an option. Most cars all have them now, but there was a time where you never had a side mirror on the passenger door. It was kind of an optional thing. So I really don't think that's going to be an issue with your car to pass.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good, because I don't really want to spend $200 for no mirror.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Steve.
You.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
All right. We have an email here. This is from Cindy. You mentioned the importance of using the parking brake, but I had an issue with that in a 1994 Nissan in the winter. It froze due to about 10 inches of the brake line being exposed to the elements. Is this still an issue, or have cars been designed to not have exposed brake lines? Currently drive a 2007 Toyota RAV and have not tested this.
Yeah. I think she's referring to the emergency or parking brake cables.
Okay.
And there were, and I don't think I see this much anymore, but there were exposed portions of the cable where it went into the sheath. Think of the cable on your 10-speed bike or your mountain bike where you can see the wire coming out of the cable.
Mm-hmm.
Picture that parking brake being on and that cable pulled out, and then ice got on there and froze it. Potentially, you could have a frozen parking brake after parking the car all night.
Sounds like that's not a good thing.
So I could see her fear, because it must have happened. Didn't she say it happened to a vehicle? An email, right?
Yes, she says it's happened to a 1994 Nissan in the winter.
Yeah. I do not believe her RAV4 has any pieces of that cable that's out in the open like that anymore. So I don't think it's a worry.
Good.
But with exposed cables, I could see the potential for it freezing on.
Hmm.
I don't think it'd be very common, but it could happen.
Well, I'm still stuck on the initial revelation. Maybe it's not a revelation to the larger public, but it is to me, about putting the parking brake on before you actually put the car into park. I'm still stuck on that.
Yeah.
But in any case, 1-800-348-2551 if you have a question, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. You can leave a message on our Facebook page. You can tweet at us. Any of those ways will get you on with Gordon Fricke here. All right, let's go back to the phones. Ray in Great Barrington. Ray, you're on.
Hi.
Hi,
can
Ray.
You hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Just a comment on the issue with a smell coming from the circulatory system, the fan system or whatever. That is caused not by a bacteria, but a mold, call it mildew. It is most common on boats, on salt water, where it can be a nightmare. The surest, cheapest, easiest way to get rid of it is a reasonable dilution of chlorine bleach.
Is that right?
Yeah. They can list anything they want on those expensive bottles at the shop. But on the other hand, you have to be careful fooling with chlorine and a strong dilution or whatnot. And I suppose you'd have to run the system to blow it out, evaporate anything that condenses in there, and keep your battery in mind. But that's it.
Yeah, I do believe
it's
you.
It's not a bacteria. It's a mold and good old chlorine.
Yes. Both.
And by the way, you might already know or be interested to know that perhaps in diesel terrestrial vehicles, but work boats, lobster boats, tuna boats, and so on, and diesel pleasure boats, believe it or not, that stuff can grow in fuel.
Yeah, that's not uncommon with
isn't
trucking.
Isn't it odd that can grow in diesel fuel? But it wreaks havoc.
It's pretty brutal stuff.
All right. Well, thanks for the tip, Ray. Take care.
See you later.
All right. Let's go next to Scott in Hebron, New York. Scott, you're on.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are
Hello?
You?
Oh, good. My question is referring back to the plastic smell. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, good. It seems to me that we didn't have car filters for, you know, unless maybe within the last few years. And at that time, and around that time, I had not heard about this musty smell in your car. I was wondering if they coincide.
Yeah, we find the cabin filters sometimes so filthy and damp and just plugged up with just all the junk in the air that they can cause the smell. And just simply replacing that cabin filter takes care of the problem. And it's a maintenance item.
I would say if it's not required by law, leave it out.
You could, because there's still a lot of cars that don't have them. The nice thing about them is, though, they're for people with allergies. They trap pollen and maybe allergens in the air. They're really a nice thing. It does improve the air going into your car, for sure.
Well, that's great, especially in the summertime, right?
You could drive without it, though. You could take it out.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things. It sounds like it works until it's clogged, and then you've got compounded problems.
Yeah, that can happen.
I just replaced one on my son's car.
Yeah.
And it wasn't expensive, you know, I'm sure it did a good job. But I probably could have got away with just say, take the thing out, throw it away, put it back together, and we'll be fine.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Scott. You take care. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. We'll take a couple more calls. The show is almost over. So we'll go to Elizabeth in Pleasant Valley, New York. Elizabeth, you're on. Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, sorry, I dropped the phone. I have an 06 Hyundai Sonata. Recently, it stopped. It still would shift. It would shift really rough from first to second and third to fourth. So I started driving it in manual mode because it's triptonic. And the other day, I was shifting up through third gear, and all of a sudden, it got stuck in third gear and would not go up or down. Also, when I shut the car off and turn it back on, it turns on in third gear.
Wow.
Can I interrupt for 1 second and ask, what exactly does triptonic transmission mean?
Well,
it's an automatic, but it can also be manually shifted.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That actually started out, that term is from Porsche. They called it a tiptronic, and you were able to shift it somewhat to your own desire rather than let it automatically shift up and down within parameters. So it's kind of a blend where you can somewhat control the automatic transmission.
Interesting.
But what I think is happening, Elizabeth, with your car, is your check engine light on?
It actually just came on, like, when it stopped shifting from third, like, when it got stuck in third.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think you may have transmission trouble or related to the transmission, and what needs to happen is you've got to bring it in and get that code scanned, and I think it's going to lead to a transmission problem, or at the very least maybe just a control problem on the outside. How many miles are on your car?
175,000.
Oh, boy, I think you may have trouble there, but I would I would get it checked. But I think you got automatic transmission problems at this stage of the car's life.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's what I thought. I just needed someone else to tell me.
All right. Thanks, Elizabeth. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right. We're heading towards the end of the show here. I just wanted to get in one more question for you. We're hearing a lot about recalls, 58 million recalls in America. I'm just wondering, how does that affect you and your business and what you see coming in?
Well, recalls all have to be handled by the dealership of the manufacturer. So as an independent repair shop, I don't see them and we can't repair or do the job, but we do get a lot of calls of people curious about what the recall is about, asking my opinion on it. Should I even bring it in to get the recall done?
Or should I get a new car entirely?
And the good thing about recalls is that they are free to the owner of the car for the entire life of the car, no matter who owns it at what point. So they should not get ignored. It's a free thing, and some of them are so important to have done because they're all driven by safety issues,
right,
that you should not ignore a recall.
All right. Thanks so much, Gordon. We are just about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. I'm sorry to those we left on the line. We'll have to catch us next time. I also like to thank Gordon Fricke for stopping by today. Support for the Vox Pop comes from 10,000 Villages in Stuyvesant Plaza, Albany, featuring fairly traded home decor and gifts handcrafted by artisans around the world. 10,000villages.com for additional store locations. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services, and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years, BoydenandParron.com, and Hubbard Hall Center for the Arts and Education, celebrating 30 years of bringing art and community together in Southern Washington County, HubbardHall.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Mary Vetter took your calls. I'm Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Tomorrow it's the Food Friday Show, and as always, we will have a special treat in store. So stay tuned now for a news update.